Blog Talk Radio.
You're a Grand Old Rag, sung by Billy Murray, Edison Record.
A feeling comes a feeling, and it sets my brain a reeling when I'm listening to the music of a military band. Any tune like Yankee Doodle simply sets me off my noodle. It's that patriotic something that no one can understand. Way down south in the land of cotton, melody untiring, ain't that inspiring? Hurrah, hurrah, we'll join the jubilee, and that's going some for the Yankees by gum. Red, white, and blue, I am for you. Honest, you're a grand old rag. You're a grand old rag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old rag. You're a grand old rag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old rag.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day. It is another wonderful day here in Northeast Kansas, which seems to be the pivotal center of Leavenworth, Atchison, Topeka, and Lawrence. Beautiful Lawrence, Kansas. Well, as you heard from our strange opening, that was from 1906, and it was considered the grand old rag. That was from a southerner, a man who probably was old enough to remember or have relatives who fought in the Civil War. So the attitude about today is Flag Day. So the attitude about the red, white, and blue is always a changing, moving target. I don't, for lack of a better term, a moving definition, depending on the mood of the nation. So I thought I'd remind people it's not a federal holiday. It's not approved by Congress. Flag Day is today. So pick your flag. Coming up in the, we've got our regular lineup of United Nations news and brief and headlines from this morning's Democracy Now! But coming up in the second hour, TUC Radio, Maria Gallardon, who creates this program off the grid from her off-the-grid home in Northern California. Her and her friends put it together, and it's a wonderful site, tucradio.org. And our ever-faithful Tristan is at the board. Tristan, would you run us? What's going to be in the second hour, the teaser from Maria Gallardon? What's in the coming up in the second hour on TUC?
It is one of the greatest speeches of modern history and one of the most pertinent speeches for us today, because we are right now, again, at the brink of nuclear war.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs on How We Can Make Peace with Russia by Learning from John F. Kennedy on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Outbreaks of waterborne diseases such as cholera and typhoid and a lack of access to care are among the devastating health impacts of the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam in southern Ukraine a week ago, the UN World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday. But the mental health toll of the flooding and displacement on the population should not be underestimated. Here's WHO's representative in Ukraine, Dr. Yarno Habich, telling reporters about mental health needs there since the full-scale Russian invasion.
There is more than 10 million people with a mental health needs. We have had attacks to civilian infrastructure in October. We went through dark and cold winter. We have lost one of the symbolic dams on the river. That means that the stress that the population goes through is growing. It could be even more people who need mental health support, and that's why we are there in the field.
Meanwhile, a Russian missile attack on the city of Kryvyi Rih in Ukraine's Dnipropetrovsk region hit a residential building on Tuesday, according to media reports, killing at least 11 civilians. The UN's top official in the country, Denise Brown, condemned the attack, insisting that civilians and civilian infrastructure should never be a target. 1 month after the deadly cyclone Mocha hit Myanmar's Rakhine state, the generals in power in the country have suspended humanitarian access, barring desperate families from getting life-saving assistance, the UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, warned on Tuesday. OCHA spokesperson Jens Lerke called the decision a devastating setback, which has paralyzed the distribution of food, water, shelter supplies, and other relief to affected communities. He said the top UN official in the country, Ramanathan Balakrishnan, described the access denial as unfathomable and warned of an increase in food insecurity and waterborne diseases as a result. He also stressed that the UN had supplies for distribution to 1 million people in Rakhine State alone, and that not only the UN but the whole humanitarian community was banned from helping those in need. Mr. Lerke called on Myanmar's State Administration Council to reconsider the decision and reinstate the initial approval for aid distributions and transportation plans. In Senegal, the use of firearms by security forces during protests sets a negative precedent for the country. That's the message from the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, after at least 16 people were killed, 350 were injured, and more than 500 arrested during 3 days of protests in Senegal between the 1st and the 3rd of June. OHCHR called on the authorities to ensure that ongoing investigations into the use of force are prompt, independent, and thorough, and that anyone found to be responsible for unnecessary or disproportionate force is brought to account regardless of their status and political affiliation. The UN Rights Office also said it was concerned over a crackdown on the freedom of expression and peaceful assembly as a private TV channel covering the protests was suspended, internet access was restricted, and permission for two other protests was denied. OHCHR called on Senegal's authorities to preserve the country's long-held respect for democratic traditions and the rule of law, and ensure that journalists can exercise their profession freely and safely, particularly in the run-up to the 2024 presidential election. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to 37 felony charges around his handling of classified documents after surrendering to federal authorities in Miami Tuesday. The counts include violations of the Espionage Act and obstruction of justice. Special Counsel Jack Smith observed proceedings in the courtroom. Outside the federal courthouse, Trump supporters gathered in what the media largely described as a circus. Trump's aide, Walt Nauta, who was also charged, appeared before the judge but did not enter a plea because he did not have a Florida lawyer. After his arraignment, Trump stopped at a Cuban restaurant in Little Havana and took photos with fans before flying to his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club, where he railed against the charges as he hosted a fundraiser for his presidential campaign.
They want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. It's very simple. They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you. They want you silent. And I am the only one that can save this nation because you know they're not coming after me, they're coming after you.
In other Trump news, a federal judge said writer E. Jean Carroll can amend her successful defamation lawsuit against Trump to include comments he made at a CNN town hall. Last month, just one day after a New York jury found Trump liable for sexually abusing Carroll in 1996, he went on to call the story fake and labeled Carroll a whack job. She's seeking another $10 million in damages on top of the $5 million she was already awarded. Ukraine reports Russian missile strikes killed three people in the Black Sea port city of Odessa and another three people in the Donetsk region early today. The U.S. says it's sending more armored vehicles as well as artillery shells and air defense missiles to Ukraine following heavy losses as its counteroffensive gets underway. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports the Biden administration will also send depleted uranium tank shells to Ukraine. Depleted uranium, a byproduct of the nuclear enrichment process, is dangerous to human health when inhaled as dust or shrapnel and can contaminate water and soil and the surrounding environment. Climate activists in Johannesburg, South Africa, protested at the offices of Standard Bank during its annual shareholder meeting Monday, demanding the company end its support for the proposed East African crude oil pipeline. The 900-mile pipeline would carry crude oil from Uganda to Tanzania before being exported to refineries in Rotterdam. France's TotalEnergies and the China National Offshore Oil Corporation are behind ECOP, working with Ugandan and Tanzanian state-owned oil firms. Kumi Naidu, the former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International and Extinction Rebellion activist Malik Dassou, were violently removed from the Standard Bank during their peaceful protest. Climate activists in Germany also held Stop ECOP protests in Bonn, where they gathered for a COP28 preparatory conference. On Tuesday, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who recently graduated from high school, spoke at the conference.
It is what we decide now that will define the rest of humanity's future. And whether we choose to do that or not, if we don't, it will be a death sentence to countless of people. And it is already a death sentence to countless of people living on the front lines of the climate crisis today.
An autopsy has revealed the Olympic track star, Tori Bowie, was 8 months pregnant and in labor when she died just over a month ago. She was alone in her home at the time and may have suffered from respiratory distress and eclampsia, a rare but life-threatening pregnancy complication. Her baby also died. Tori Bowie, a three-time Olympic medalist, was just 32 years old. Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy and childbirth complications than white women. Her Olympic teammate, Tiana Tichel Bartoletta, posted on Twitter, quote, as of June 2023, three of the four members of Team USA's 4x100-meter relay team who ran the second fastest time in history and brought home three gold medals have nearly died or did die in childbirth. We deserve better. Hashtag Black Maternal Health Crisis. A Black Mississippi civil rights attorney was arrested while filming a traffic stop as part of her work investigating discriminatory police practices. Jill Jefferson, who was held in jail for 2 nights before being released Monday, had filed a federal lawsuit against the Lexington Police Force alleging a culture of corruption and racism. The ACLU of Mississippi said her arrest by Lexington police, quote, reeks of retaliation. In Arley, Montana, Community members are engaging in a series of awareness walks this week to demand justice for Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old Indigenous woman who was struck and killed in March by a driver as she was walking home along a highway in the early morning hours. The driver was identified as Sunny White, a suspected white nationalist whose children are reportedly named Aryan and Nation, and were in the car at the time of the crash. Sunny White has not been charged in connection with Westwolf's death. Micah Westwolf was a member of the Blackfeet tribe and was also Diné, Cree, and Klamath. She was an avid athlete and poet. Cornel West has switched party affiliation and is now running to be the Green Party's 2024 presidential nominee. The author, civil rights activist, and professor of philosophy announced earlier this month he would run as a candidate with the People's Party. West confirmed the news on the Katie Halper Show.
Which means when it comes to infrastructure and institution, it's much broader and deeper. Access to the ballot, much broader. But in the end, as you know, this, you know, any candidacy to run the empire in order to dismantle the empire has to be part of a movement.
You can see our recent interview with Cornel West on his presidential run at democracynow.org. In media news, Los Angeles public radio station LAist, formerly KPCC, announced it's cutting staff by some 12% due to a budget shortfall. Members of the LAist union noted that the station's current CEO made around $675,000 last year, while the former CEO has been paid $500,000 per year 3 years after leaving the job. This comes less than a week after the LA Times said it would lay off 74 staffers, representing 13% of the editorial members. UPS has agreed to mandate air conditioning in its delivery fleet as part of ongoing negotiations with workers in the Teamsters Union. A number of UPS delivery drivers have become sick from working in extreme temperatures. Last summer, a 24-year-old UPS driver in Southern California died on the job, which his family said was caused by the heat. This comes as some 330,000 union members are voting to authorize a possible August strike against UPS in what would be the largest single employer strike in U.S. history. At least 59 migrants drowned earlier today after their boat capsized off the Greek coast. Over 100 people were rescued, though it's not clear how many passengers were on the Italy-bound vessel before it sank. It's the deadliest shipwreck off the Greek coast this year. In related news, the International Organization for Migration says it recorded nearly 3,800 deaths in 2022 along land and sea routes in the Middle East and North Africa region, an 11% jump from the previous year. This comes as the UN said the global level of forced displacement has reached a record 110 million people.
This is where we stand today. We have 110 million people that have fled because of conflict, persecution, discrimination, violence, often mixed with other motives, in particular the impact of climate change.
Conflicts in Sudan and Ukraine are causing millions to flee. Syria and Afghanistan also continue to record massive numbers of refugees and displaced people. The mounting displacement crisis comes as aid agencies face severe funding shortages. The World Food Program says it'll be forced to cut aid to Syria by about a half, affecting 2.5 million people in need. In Nigeria, a boat carrying guests returning from a wedding capsized, killing some 100 passengers. The tragedy, which also claimed the lives of children, occurred overnight Monday on the Niger River. Israeli forces killed a 19-year-old Palestinian and injured at least eight others during a raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The soldiers were searching for another man when they started firing on people in the vicinity of his home. This is the brother of the wanted man who said their house was surrounded by Israeli forces who threatened to bomb it and kill everyone inside.
Suddenly they shoot at people. A young child that was walking with groceries was shot. We knew it was the army. Then we heard them calling on megaphones for Assam to surrender. We know you were inside the house.
Meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is in China this week after Beijing offered to facilitate peace talks with Israel. And in Massachusetts, Governor Mara Healey unveiled a new green bank that will be focused on affordable housing and environmental justice. The Massachusetts Community Climate Bank is part of the state's effort to cut emissions by half by 2030 and to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. This is Governor Healey.
We're going to be putting forward opportunities, tools to decarbonize buildings, which are, as I said, a major source of emissions. This climate bank is going to grow over time to address the urgent needs across this sector. We're going to be able to innovate and finance deep energy retrofits, on-site electric vehicle charging, and solar projects that will demonstrate the viability of these technologies at a community-wide scale.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade. It's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Royal Mead, drunk men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy tears. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Canada is basically on fire from the Pacific to the Atlantic in this June of 2023. The wildfire season starting so early in spring is brand new, driven by climate heat. Asia experienced temperatures too hot to work outside, and it lasted for weeks. Last week, Shanghai set its highest temperature record ever. Add in humidity, and countless millions in the East are hiding inside or living in hot misery or dying in it. Western media hardly reports this major event. The Caribbean is also rocket hot, with Puerto Rico enduring temperatures beyond human endurance. All this comes before El Niño, the great change in Pacific currents, leading to hotter years and even more fire weather. Yes, climate change is here, years early with a vengeance. We were warned. This week, we go back to two classic interviews that revealed the future of our age. These are the fundamentals. The program is called The Fork in the Road. Please listen again, and then pass this on out as far as you can.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Coming up, The Fork in the Road towards the unsustainable hothouse Earth, or a human-stabilized planet where we have to monitor and keep track of the temperature and make it go right. We will hear one of my 2018 interviews with Professor Will Steffen. It is about one of the most important scientific papers in this century. And then we search for the tipping points that could force the climate into hothouse Earth. These are the planetary boundaries. You will hear top Swedish scientist Johan Rockström on Radio EcoShock as I recorded it in 2016. Let's get going. Professor Will Steffen told us.
So even when we know climate change is coming and it's going to be dangerous, can we really make a plan to survive the breakdown of society? I mean, isn't the point being that society breaks down and things don't work anymore?
Yeah, I think the point is we need to do everything we can to avoid that sort of scenario. And there's a lot of people are now saying time is running out rapidly to avoid that. And this is really, in a way, the fork in the road that we envisaged in that 2018 paper on Earth system trajectories. that the fork in that pathway between stabilized Earth and hot house Earth probably lies this decade, maybe in the first half of the decade. Certainly, I think by 2030, we will have put ourselves on one of the other pathways, and it'll be difficult to shift. That's why it's extremely important now that people understand the seriousness of this risk and understand that the students are right. This is an emergency situation, and we actually do have to make the right choices over the next couple of years.
In 2019, the same team published a paper on feedbacks that could take us to hothouse Earth. I have to look into that further. To really understand where we are and where we are headed, I will read you a couple of key paragraphs from the 2018 paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. The authors, led by Will Steffen, say this of stabilized Earth. This analysis implies that even if the Paris Accord target of 1.5 degrees C to 2 degrees C rise in temperature is met, we cannot exclude the risk that a cascade of feedbacks could push the Earth system irreversibly into a hothouse Earth pathway. The challenge that humanity faces is to create a stabilized Earth pathway that steers the Earth system away from its current trajectory toward the threshold beyond which is hothouse Earth. The human-created stabilized Earth pathway leads to a basin of attraction that is not likely to exist in the Earth system's stability landscape without human stewardship to create and maintain it. Creating such a pathway and basin of attraction requires a fundamental change in the role of humans on the planet. This stewardship role requires deliberate and sustained action to become an integral, adaptive part of Earth system dynamics, creating feedbacks that keep the system on a stabilized Earth pathway. They continue, if the world's societies want to avoid crossing a potential threshold that locks the Earth system into the hothouse Earth pathway, then it is critical they make deliberate decisions to avoid this risk and maintain the Earth system in Holocene-like conditions. This human-created pathway is what we call stabilized Earth, and that's where the Earth system is maintained in a state with a temperature rise no greater than 2 degrees C above pre-industrial, a super Holocene state. Stabilized Earth could require deep cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, protection and enhancement of biosphere carbon sinks, efforts to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, possibly solar radiation management, and adaptation to unavoidable impacts of the warming already occurring. In essence, the stabilized Earth pathway could be conceptualized as a regime of the Earth system in which humanity plays an active planetary stewardship role. We emphasize that stabilized Earth is not an intrinsic state of the Earth system, but rather one in which humanity commits to a pathway of ongoing management of its relationship with the rest of the Earth system. That was a reading from the paper Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene, as published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, August 14, 2018. Let's go to my interview with lead author Will Steffen about this overview of our plight.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A Radio EcoShock replay from 2018.
Planet Earth is hurtling towards a new, hotter state. But how hot? Are there landing spots that are safe enough for a human civilization? We get a big step towards answers with new science published by the National Academy on August 6th. The title is Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. The paper is from a distinguished team of scientists led by Dr. Will Steffen. Will was educated in the American South and transplanted to Australia, where he led research institutes and advised governments. Currently, Dr. Steffen is an emeritus professor at the Australian National University and a counselor with the Climate Council of Australia. He is also a senior fellow at the Stockholm Resilience Center. Will Steffen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I have to tell you, it's been a horrible summer in the Northern Hemisphere. The global fire map is like something I've never seen. I was wiped out by smoke, and other regions were whipped with strings of wet and windy storms. Will, do you think we have already embarked on serious climate change?
Yeah, I certainly have. And you could mirror that down here in the Southern Hemisphere. When you look across Australia, we've had a couple of mass bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef, killing a high percentage. I think up to 30% of that reef is gone. We've seen fires, too. In fact, our fire season is extending at both ends, and it's now occupying 11 months out of the 12 months of the year. We've got serious drought now in New South Wales and Queensland. So, yeah, I think climate disruption is happening at an alarming rate pretty much right around the planet.
Now, to begin, for the layperson, is there a difference between a tipping point, as popularized by Al Gore, 12 years ago, and the thresholds that you look for in this paper?
No, they're pretty much the same thing. We use the term tipping element, which is actually the physical system which could, within it, have a tipping point or threshold. So those two terms are used pretty much synonymously. In our paper, what we're trying to say is that in addition to individual parts of the Earth having tipping points, example being the Arctic sea ice or perhaps the Amazon rainforest, we're talking about a number of these things acting together.
Well, I'd like to go through the four main questions you worked with in order, and they're understandable to all of us and go far beyond just scientific curiosity. These are things we need to know and that governments need to know. So question one, quote, is there a planetary threshold in the trajectory of the Earth system that, if crossed, could prevent stabilization in a range of intermediate temperature rises? That's a pretty scary question, isn't it? Could you explain it a bit?
Yeah, look, I think the dominant framework for the climate change issue is that our emissions of greenhouse gases will be the dominant driver no matter how hot it gets. In other words, the more we emit, the hotter it gets. Once we stop emitting, the Earth is going to stay there. In other words, we could park it at 2 or 3 degrees and it'll stay there. We're saying that the Earth is not a simple system. It's a complex system. And a lot of complex systems have behavior which looks at sharp transitions between a couple of well-defined states. So our argument is that there are a number of individual tipping elements that have their own thresholds in the Earth system, plus some other feedbacks which may not have thresholds but still accelerate climate change. These can act together like a stack of dominoes. When you start pushing one domino, it knocks another off and another off, and together that line of dominoes falling constitutes a planetary threshold. So we are hypothesizing with a fair bit of evidence that there exists a planetary threshold somewhere probably between 1.5 and 2 degrees and 4 degrees, that if we go across that, the Earth system, it's going to move to a much hotter state out of our control. So that's basically what that first question is designed to address. And in our paper, we say, yes, there is likely to be a planetary threshold.
And you've already talked really about the second question, which is, if there is a threshold, where is it, or maybe when is it? And you've touched on that. So question three, quote, if a threshold is crossed, what are the implications, especially for the well-being of human societies? Okay, well, there are whole books written about possible impacts of a hotter world, but can you give us some clues?
Yeah, well, one of the things you'd obviously see is an enormous increase in extreme weather events. And we're already seeing some of this, but this would be extreme weather on steroids. It'd be fires, droughts, extreme heat, big changes in rainfall, extreme rainfall events, worse tropical cyclones or hurricanes in the Northern Hemisphere, and so on. That's an obvious one. But I think another one that's sort of a sleeper there that people don't think about so much is that we have designed and built our civilizations around reasonably stable patterns of temperature and rainfall. For example, big agricultural zones, central USA is a good example, Western Europe is a good example, Indo-Gangetic Plain, Northeast China. These together feed billions of people. And if we cross the threshold and rapidly go toward a hothouse Earth state, all of those systems are going to be disrupted. And it's hard to predict exactly how they're going to be disrupted. So what this means is just something as simple and basic as providing food for the human population is going to become a massive and difficult task. So that's a good example of what's coming our way. Another one is that sea level is going to rise and continue to rise for centuries and centuries as we go on to a hothouse Earth trajectory. We're estimating somewhere between 20 and 40 meters of sea level rise could eventuate way down the track. It takes a long time for the ice to melt. But you could get sea level rise rates as high as 2 meters a century. And that's a pretty high rate. That now comes into a human perspective. in terms of a very large amount of coastal infrastructure that then becomes vulnerable. And you can go on and on. It's not a very pretty picture when you actually start looking at it in detail.
Well, I'd like to leave until later the question about what human actions could save us from the worst of a hothouse world. It's important, but there's a couple things I'd like to get to first, including in the AR5, or the fifth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That was finalized in 2014, and it talked about a medium confidence that a threshold for abrupt and irreversible climate change exists. Does your paper go beyond medium confidence that that threshold is there?
Yeah, I think we've got much higher confidence than that, because as we say, all of these processes that would form a planetary threshold, we've seen how they've operated in the past, so they're real processes. Also, we have a fair bit of evidence that some of them, even at a 1 degree temperature rise, are being destabilized. Arctic sea ice is a good example of that. Amazon forest is another example of that, and so on. And we see weakening of longer-term ocean and terrestrial carbon sinks. So this isn't fanciful stuff. These things are already starting to happen. So I think we could reinforce what the IPCC said and say that with new knowledge, we could upgrade that probability to higher than medium. Now we've really got to do some work to try to pin down a little bit more precisely where that threshold might lie in terms of temperature rise.
But does this threshold idea compare with the planetary boundaries advanced by your co-author Johan Rockström and his team in Sweden?
Very much so, because what we're saying is, and the planetary boundaries are a reasonably conservative approach, saying that if we want to be really certain or with a very high degree of probability that we're going to maintain a Holocene-like state of the Earth system, then we have to make sure we avoid these thresholds and these feedback processes. So we've set boundaries for 9 processes. One of them is obviously CO2 in the atmosphere, but there are others, like the amount of important biomes, forests you can lose, and things like that. So the planetary boundaries approach is actually saying, if you want to be really sure that you're going to avoid the sort of hothouse Earth trajectory we're painting in this paper, then you stay within the boundaries.
Is the hothouse Earth pathway different from runaway climate change, as Dr. James Hansen once suggested was possible?
It depends on what you mean by runaway. We never use the term because it's something that we don't talk about in complex systems theory or analysis. What we're saying is that there are other states of the Earth system which are actually stable. They don't run away, but they are much hotter than the one that we've developed our civilizations in. And what we're saying is that one of those states, the hothouse Earth one, could be accessible if we cross these thresholds. So we're hypothesizing that if you cross that threshold, you get a period of very rapid climate change. But this isn't runaway. It's going to restabilize at a hotter state with much less ice at the poles, much higher sea levels, different rainfall patterns, and so on. And we've seen a state like that in the recent past. The so-called mid-Miocene, about 15 or 16 million years ago, was just like that state, and the continents were about in the same configuration. So this sort of thing is plausible. So no, we don't use the term runaway. It's going to keep going on forever. But the Earth could shift to a much hotter, much less hospitable, stable state.
It worries me a bit that this paper calls for stewardship of the entire Earth system, including the biosphere. Frankly, we've utterly failed at stewardship. The idea of humans running the biosphere is a bit frightening to me. Maybe we need to greatly decrease our numbers and impacts to allow the biosphere to self-regulate. What do you say?
Well, that's a good point. And stewardship isn't management. They're two very different terms. In fact, stewardship, in my view of the word and its proper meaning, is that we really manage ourselves to become good stewards, which is exactly what you say, allow natural processes to reestablish. In other words, we need to protect major biomes like the Amazon rainforest. We don't manage it. We just take our pressure off of it. So I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think if you read the supplementary info, we had some limited space in the main text. We go into more detail about what stewardship actually entails. But we were very careful not to use the word management, but to use the word stewardship.
The mainstream chatter is usually about technological fixes needed to keep this civilization, we hope, going more or less the way it is. But your paper goes beyond that, calling for, quote, behavioral changes, new governance arrangements, and transformed social values. Maybe that's more important than a technical fix. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. And that's a point I think we made very clearly, so I'm glad you picked up on that. technological fixes is more of the same. And the more you look at them, the more they're taking the old cause-effect linear logic without considering that those actions are embedded in a complex system that may surprise you with how they react. So a transformed value system is, as you said earlier, we become stewards of the system, which means we actually manage ourselves to take pressure off of the Earth system and allow many of the natural processes and feedbacks to operate. They've kept the place stable for about 12,000 years and allowed us to develop, and now we're really, really disrupting that. So you're absolutely right. I think the other thing I'll just say quickly, we've had 2 decades of really understanding the climate change problem, and we've made virtually no progress at getting on top of it. So that just tells you, just from pure observation, that the present system is failing really, really badly. So that's why we actually said, it's more than technology. It's more than fiddling a bit at the edges. We actually have to really transform ourselves, our societies, and our value systems.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with my guest, Dr. Will Steffen. Will is known internationally in climate circles and beyond, and he's based in Australia, but he also works with the Stockholm Resilience Center. We're talking about a new paper that lays out possible futures for the world climate, and some are livable and others not so much. So, Will, Figure 3 in the new paper is titled Global Map of Potential Tipping Cascades. What is a tipping cascade?
Well, this is like the row of dominoes, where one of these individual processes that has a tipping point tips, and it changes the Earth system. It can melt ice and uncover more dark ocean or land, which absorbs more sunlight, heats the planet more, or it can emit CO2 or methane to the atmosphere, or both, which warm the Earth further. And as the Earth warms further, more of these tipping elements then become vulnerable. They start to tip. They increase the temperature further. Some of these elements actually operate by changing ocean circulation, which moves heat through the ocean from hemisphere to hemisphere. So there are a number of connections that once you start tipping some of these elements, they change the Earth system such that they tip other elements. And it's I think the best analogy is a sort of winding row of dominoes where we start knocking the first couple over and it takes off. So that's what we call a tipping cascade. And this is the fundamental process underneath the fact that the planet as a whole may have a threshold.
This is very interesting to me because, in a way, I've been having an argument with Dr. Guy McPherson about tipping points. And he said that positive feedback loops can work on each other and make each other go stronger. And in a way, that's what your graphic shows.
That's exactly what we're saying. Yep, that's a good way of putting it.
All right. And apparently, we can never go back. Have we already knocked out the cycle of glaciers known for the past few million years?
Yes, I think there's good evidence that we will not go into the next glaciation. So we'll miss that. So we'll miss a glaciation for about 100,000 years just with what we've already done to the Earth system. Now, some people may argue that's a good thing, but in fact, that's only the beginning of what's happening if we keep on our present trajectory. And that's what this paper is arguing, is that if we keep on the present trajectory, we're going to go to a much, much hotter state of the Earth system. So that, of course, would eliminate glaciations for even longer than 100,000 years, probably.
What's our best hope for a stabilized Earth?
That's a good question, and I think people in the humanities and social sciences may have a better answer than I do. All I would say is that we scientists, I think natural scientists, have to do a better job of articulating what the real risks are, and that's what this paper is intended to do. It's intended to be a wake-up call to say we really need to reframe the risks of what we're doing to the planet's climate system and to the Earth system as a whole. I think humanities scholars and social science scholars would have some good ideas about how we actually do start getting a transformation of values, a reorganization of societies, and so on. That's a bit outside of my area of expertise, only to say that I think we have enough evidence to say our present system isn't going to solve this problem, so we have to think and act at a much deeper level to transform our societies.
Well, I'm going to try and go a little deep here, and I can't explain it very well because I'm not a scientist, but I noticed that Dr. Joachim, or John Schellenhuber, is a co-author of your new paper. And in his 2011 speech at the 4 degrees or More conference in Australia, which I broadcast on Radio EcoShock, he said something that always made me wonder. Now, according to my blog notes about that speech, he said, studies in physics show the temperature is unlikely to stay anywhere around the 7 degrees C hotter mark. simple calculations about the wave patterns of matter, he said, suggest the temperature would either rest around 5 degrees or keep migrating up to 10 degrees hotter, where there's another kind of natural plateau. And your paper also talks about possible resting points based on potential energy of the system. It's deep stuff, but can you comment?
Yeah, look, ours roughly corresponds with John's 5 degrees. We're suggesting 4 and 5 degrees. John's a really excellent theoretical physicist on top of everything else he knows about the Earth system. So he's attacking it from one angle. We're looking at, for example, analogs in the past. So you can see that the Earth system has existed for long periods of time, millions of years, in certain states, and then it transitions between these states. And one of these states we see in the recent past, of course, is one that's about 4 or 5 degrees hotter than today, much less ice, quite different climate system. And that, we think, could be accessible if we cross those thresholds or get that cascade going in the next couple of decades.
And there has been a kind of monoculture among some climate scientists and climate activists where it's all about the carbon. But humans have plenty of other impacts, like driving species extinct or cutting down forests or polluting with plastics, and some of those could change the biosphere that supports climate stability. So I was relieved your study went beyond simple carbon counting. Do we need more of that in science?
Absolutely. The paper does focus on the climate system, but again, in the supporting information, you'll see a broader view of the Earth system as a whole. And I think a good way of looking at it is we have the Earth system is made up of two big interacting spheres at the highest level, the geosphere, which people focus on, the physical climate system, but also a biosphere. And in fact, carbon is a beautiful link between the two. We think of carbon only as something that warms the climate if you put too much of it in the atmosphere, but in fact, it's the real currency of the biosphere itself. And we're changing, in addition to burning fossil fuels, of course, we're changing the biosphere directly in a myriad ways. And that, at the moment, is actually more important than the climate impacts on the biosphere. So, yes, it's extremely important that we take a much more holistic, integrated view of the Earth system and of human impacts on the Earth system.
Well, as I said, here in British Columbia and all along the west coast of America, we've just gone through another terror summer of wildfires with massive smoke. And I wonder if the release of all that carbon from trees could affect the climate. Your paper says it's possible, yes?
It certainly is. In fact, one of the tipping elements or tipping processes we talk about are the vast boreal forests of Canada, Alaska, Siberia, Scandinavia. And yes, they can emit a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. So, and we see the best data, in fact, is from Canada, that we see long-term changes that the Canadian forests were basically a sink. They were a net absorber of carbon for much of the 20th century. But around about the 1970s or so, as temperatures started creeping up, we saw, particularly in Western Canada, an increase in spruce bark beetle attacks on the trees, which weakened the trees and made them more prone to disturbances. And of course, with ever-increasing temperature, fires became more probable. And so you had this double whammy of trees weakened by insect attacks and then fires sweeping through them. And the Canadian Forest Service has done an excellent job of actually tracking the carbon implications of all that and found that over the 30 years post-1970, those forests have gone to being carbon neutral at best and sometimes even net emitters of carbon to the atmosphere. So that's already a big effect on the global carbon cycle.
And what would be the worst trajectory, this hothouse Earth? What would it be like if humans survived to see it?
Okay, if you look at, for example, Australia, much of Australia would be uninhabitable. You simply couldn't live there unless people were trucking in water and you lived in air-conditioned conditions for 24/7. And you can do that around the Earth. Large areas of the tropics and subtropics become uninhabitable. As I said before, the world's big agricultural zones would have to change. Most of them would be damaged beyond repair by a rapidly changing climate. Sea levels would just continuously rise. Extreme weather events would be much, much worse than they are now. And John Schellenhuber himself, I think in that 2011 lecture he gave at Melbourne, said it's not inconceivable that if we go to something like a hothouse Earth, we will have a civilization and population crash. And he suggested down to maybe a maximum carrying capacity of 1 billion humans. We're about 7.5 now. So this is really a collapse scenario. And that's what I think the worst case scenario is, in fact, a collapse scenario. that the contemporary civilization we have today simply cannot exist in a hothouse Earth.
Yes, and we know people have to slash greenhouse gas emissions to keep a livable world, and we've had experts on this show go further, saying we will need to reduce incoming sunlight with geoengineering. But your group adds a third way, namely, quote, enhancing or creating carbon sinks. Well, what can we do there?
Well, obviously, the first thing we can do is protect and restore a lot of the terrestrial sinks that we talked about, Amazon, other tropical forests, some temperate forests, protect the boil. But also there's a huge potential carbon sink in the ocean. The ocean's a big player in the carbon cycle. So protecting coastal zones, they absorb a lot of carbon. There have been proposals that macroalgae, big seaweed, can be enhanced, the growth of that, and that would absorb a lot of carbon. Of course, you've got to get that then down deeper in the ocean to have it there for any length of time. So basically, the way we look at it is about a quarter of the carbon that's up there today that's causing the problem actually originated from the biosphere. So getting that back into the biosphere and protecting it would actually be a big step forward. Of course, that's no substitute for fossil fuel, and that's the problem. A lot of people think, well, we'll just grow trees. No, it's not a substitute at all. All it does is restore some of the earlier emissions from the biosphere.
So if we want to have a habitable world, it sounds like we need to change everything, our consumption, our behavior, our attitudes. I've studied history. I have difficulty recalling such a huge revolution in such a short time frame, maybe at the start of World War II, maybe. Is it really still possible, Will Steffen, to steer Earth without going into that hellish hothouse ditch?
Good question. I think it's a big ask. I think we may have some chance to do it. Humans can move extremely quickly. There are tipping points and radical changes of state in human societies as well, often on the catastrophic side, but occasionally you see societies that reform themselves reasonably quickly. We did after World War II. That's probably the most recent example of where older, more feudal systems around the world were torn down really by this succession of World War I, Great Depression, World War II. And there were quite different economic and governance systems that came out of that. So that was one example, but it took some catastrophic events to trigger that. This time, by the time we get to really catastrophic events, it may be too late if we're right on our hothouse Earth and planetary threshold. So we have to have the foresight to transform ourselves before we actually get into a situation where the Earth system is out of control.
Yes, foresight. That's what we need. So you have advised the Australian government in various ways, and lately Australian politics have gone further off the rails towards more coal development and climate denial. Meanwhile, as you say, farmers in New South Wales are allowed to shoot kangaroos because the drought is so awful. What now for Australia?
Well, I think we're actually, if you look at Australia, Australian society is somewhat in a complex systems view. We're getting much more variability now in the system. Over the past 10 years, we've gone from prime ministers who've vigorously supported action on climate change. We put in a meaningful carbon price. That got overthrown. Now we're going through a succession of prime ministers at an increasing rate, mainly because of the climate change issue. That's the underlying thing that's destabilizing politics. But at the subnational level, we have some really positive signs. States like South Australia are already over 50% renewable. Our own little Australian Capital Territory, which is sort of the equivalent of D.C. in the U.S., will be 100% renewable in about 18 months. And we've done that over about 8 or 9 years. So, and that's a city of about 500,000. So you can transform really fast if you put your mind to it. And I think Canberra's crossed a tipping point where now, although there was a lot of angst about how much it would cost to get carbon out of our electricity system, now we want to get carbon out of our entire territory economy by 2045. And it's got widespread support, no problem from the Treasury and economists. So I think we've crossed a tipping point to realize we can actually do this. And it's actually going to benefit us in other ways in addition to the climate benefits. So I'm hoping that things like this, that these social tipping points can come in time to help us get on the right pathway.
It sounds like people and the local governments have just gone ahead well past what the retrograde national government is doing, and that offers some hope for the United States as well.
Indeed. I think that's a good example, too, in the United States. And there's probably a reason for that. I think the big vested interests that want to maintain the fossil fuel world operate at the big levels in governance, operate at the nation-state levels, whereas people who actually understand the risks and feel the impacts already today, want to get on with solving it. And the best thing they can do now without getting the national governments moving is to get moving at the local level. And that's happening around Australia too.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
All I would say is make one more point to your listeners. Often people, when I talk about this paper and other aspects of my work, they say, oh, but, you know, give us hope. Can you please give us some hope? And my answer is, actually, you make hope. People themselves make hope. And that's what we've done in Canberra. We've got a much better attitude toward this problem because we're actually going out and doing things and making a difference. So my response to people is, you can do something. And the best thing you can do is get active on this, change your local politics, try to change your national politics. That'll generate hope.
We've been speaking with Dr. Will Steffen, Emeritus Professor at the Australia National University and part of the Climate Council of Australia. He's the lead author of a new paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. It is available in full text for free, and you can find links to that, plus some quotes and comments, in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Will Steffen, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
One of my climate heroes is Dr. Hans Joachim, or John Schellenhuber. Early on, Schellenhuber dared to ask the question, what if we go beyond 4 degrees C of heating? There were two conferences on that. The first was at Oxford. I broadcast Schellenhuber's speech from the second, held in Australia. You can find that program and my detailed notes on his speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. It's still important. In his 2011 speech at the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia, Dr. Schellenhuber revealed something that always made me wonder. He said studies in physics show the temperature is unlikely to stay anywhere around 7 degrees C. Simple calculations about the wave patterns of matter suggest the temperature would either rest around 5 degrees or keep migrating up to 10 degrees hotter where there is another natural plateau. The later 2018 paper also talks about possible resting points based on the potential energy system. It's deep stuff, and Schellenhuber is one of the top physicists, so I believe him. Find links to my radio broadcast of that keynote speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. If we push the planet into the track for hothouse Earth, it will be due to crossing planetary boundaries. These are the so-called tipping points, where large natural systems begin to release more greenhouse gases than we do, and more than the current climate system can tolerate. Here is my Radio EcoShock interview with Johan Rockström, the Swedish leader of Planetary Boundaries.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
There are limits to what humanity can do on this planet and still survive. Johan Rockström has led a team that mapped out those planetary boundaries. Rockström is the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center. He teaches at Stockholm University and holds many roles in the scientific community. We'll talk about his latest book, written with Matthias Klum, Big World, Small Planet. Johan Rockström, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and a great honor to be with you.
One boundary set by world governments in Paris was to avoid heating the planet 2 degrees C above the pre-industrial levels. Some scientists say 2 degrees of warming is already built in. We're heading into the danger zone. Do you agree or disagree?
No, I agree. You know, the planetary boundary science, which is the basis of the book Big World, Small Planet, concludes exactly in line with what you're saying, that the climate planetary boundary, in fact, is even lower than 2 degrees Celsius. We put it at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the aim that the Paris Climate Agreement, in the end, really, really set out for, which means that it aligned itself with science. Now, the drama here is that we have already warmed the planet with an average temperature rise of 1 degree Celsius, but a lot of science indicates clearly that we are very soon, if not already today, committed to almost 1.5 degrees Celsius because of all the heat which is stored in the ocean, and because of the cooling caused by air pollution, which is a paradox, that actually air pollution, which destroys the health of people, is actually helping us by cooling the planet by basically shedding away incoming solar radiation. So we are probably close to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and we're moving very quickly towards 2 degrees Celsius. So yes, there is a danger zone there. However, there is a lot of evidence on the plate today showing clearly that we can transition towards a decarbonized future faster than we had previously thought, thanks to the ability to scale economically attractive renewable energy technologies, from photovoltaics to wind power to biomass to different forms of, you know, hydro and even nuclear to some extent, which can allow us to transition quickly. And what science also shows very clearly is if we want to settle at around 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, meaning below 2 degrees Celsius, we will not only have to decarbonize and leave the fossil fuel era behind us within, you know, 30, 40 years, we also need to transition into a phase in the second part of this century where we have negative emissions, meaning we take out more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than we are emitting into the atmosphere. And this can be done by working both with nature, using biomass, for example, plants and trees that take up carbon dioxide and transform it into charcoal and plug it back into the soil, or through different kinds of geoengineering systems, which we call carbon capture and storage, where you backplug technologies in coal-fired plants, for example, to suck out carbon dioxide, concentrate it, and suck it back into the crust of the Earth. So even though it's absolutely true that we are in a very dire situation and there's an urgency, there is increasing evidence that a transition into a world below 2 degrees Celsius, below the climate planetary boundary, is actually doable, even though the situation is challenging.
Under a high emission scenario, if we don't make that, I have seen maps projecting wide bands of deserts around the subtropics in this century. You are known for in-depth research on water resources and how to farm with less. Can we cope with changes to agriculture under climate change?
Yeah, this is a very important question. Now, and there are two parts of answer. I mean, one is where you started off. You're absolutely right. We are following a pathway. If we continue business as usual, if we do not implement what we have now promised from heads of state of all the world's countries to do in Paris, then yes, we would be first hitting right through the ceiling of the climate planetary boundary of staying under 2 degrees, and we would very likely take us to 3-4 degrees Celsius, which can be described in no other way than being a disastrous future for humanity, from the drought-prone agricultural regions in the center of the U.S. all the way to the tropical, vulnerable countries across Africa and the low-lying island states in the Indian and Pacific Oceans that would have to be evacuated even. So yes, that would be a very dangerous scenario, and the number one victim is everything that depends on fresh water, and among those is really food production as the first victim. But on the other hand, we can see, as I mentioned earlier, the possibility of transitioning in line with the Paris Agreement to avoid those most dangerous outcomes, meaning that passing 2 degrees Celsius, it would still require clearly major investments in adaptation. Remember that the last time we had 1 degree Celsius warming, and when the planet finally stabilized itself after that disequilibrium caused by 1 degree warming, we had on average 6 meters sea level rise on Earth. So, you know, we're very likely, even if we wouldn't reach that high level of change, to be forced to invest heavily in dealing with the rising frequency of droughts, rising frequency of heat waves, rising frequency of disease, and an irreversible increase in sea level rise. So, you know, however we twist and turn this, we will have to adapt to unavoidable change, but we have to avoid unmanageable change.
Now, at a TED talk, Johan, you told an audience that climate change may not actually be our greatest challenge. What did you mean by that?
Yes, and that is scientifically supported, even though I recognize how provocatively it can appear, because, of course, the global climate crisis is debated and at the center stage of our focus, and, of course, it is a major, major challenge. However, we are at the sixth mass extinction of species in the world. We are, therefore, as human beings, killing off everything from pollinators to large predators like tigers and cod and sharks at a pace equivalent with a global mass extinction. Among these six mass extinctions, by the way, is, for example, when we lost the dinosaurs some 65 million years ago due to an asteroid catastrophe. So we are in a very, very dire situation with regards to losing biodiversity. Now, remember that losing species on this earth is not a moral issue just to protect everyone's right to exist as living beings. It is really our toolbox to allow ourselves to have a good well-being on this planet, because we need biodiversity to, you know, capture carbon, clean water, have good quality of air, and to produce food. So there's no other way than, you know, maintaining nature to have a good future. Now, the dilemma is the following. These are two crises, biodiversity crisis, climate crisis. However, the climate crisis has a perfect substitution. We can follow the conventional economic theory to say, okay, we recognize that oil, coal, and natural gas is too dangerous, it's too costly, and therefore does not deliver. And moreover, we're reaching a situation with peak of cheap fossil fuel sources, such as oil. So we transition into a substitute and therefore can deliver modern energy supply through solar voltaics, wind, biomass, hydro, nuclear, and other innovations. This is what economic theory has always as the way we can move towards innovation and development. And we're seeing evidence that this can be done. So we actually have a solution which moreover can deliver for human well-being. How is it on biodiversity? Well, you see, there's no substitute. You lose a species and it's gone forever. There's no regret period. You lose fresh water or you run out of fresh water, there's no alternative. So biodiversity and what we call the living nature, fresh water, land, biodiversity, has no substitution. There's only one way and one solution, which is to safeguard the natural capital we have. And that is much tougher because it requires that we understand the need to preserve what we have to allow our children and future generations to thrive on Earth. So that is why I'm saying that perhaps we might find in the end, paradoxically, that the climate challenge is the easier one because we actually have a substitutable, economically viable solution, while biodiversity is a much more complex and spread and deeper and fatal outcome.
Johann, what is the fourth industrial revolution and what could that mean?
Yes, so this is both a great excitement but also a concern if we, so to say, allow it to live on its own. The fourth industrial revolution is the notion which is backed up by more and more evidence and coming not least from the great innovation powerhouses in the U.S., from Silicon Valley to MIT and the great corporations you have in the U.S., showing that we are right at the verge, as we speak right now, starting a new exponential journey into the digital revolution going to scale in the world, nanotechnology, biotechnology, allowing us to truly be able to think of a world where we can achieve basically abundance for all in the world by taking a major step in terms of delivery of goods and services thanks to or because of technological advancements, and that this is going very, very fast. Now, that is good news. It allows us to move and take a major next step into a modern future in the 21st century. The challenge, though, is the following. We know if you look into the past, that essentially all technological advancements have accelerated our journey towards unsustainable development. It has sped up our ability to undermine resources and ecosystems and climate on Earth. So if an industrial revolution is allowed to occur on its own, it could actually accelerate our journey towards hitting these planetary boundaries even more severely. So our hypothesis in the Big World Small Planet, what we're suggesting is that a fourth industrial revolution has to be capped by planetary boundaries. And perhaps surprising to many is that our very deep conviction is that that would not halt the industrial revolution. It would rather deepen it even further. You know, if you say, oh, it's not enough to be really, really superbly innovative when it comes to the next generation of vehicles or next generation of aviation or next generation of smartphones, they also have to now be entirely sustainable, possible to recycle, and occur within a safe operating space. I believe that that would deepen the innovation even further and make us even smarter. So there's no contradiction between planetary boundaries and the fourth industrial revolution, but it's an exciting but also very challenging moment.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish scientist Johan Rockström. In your book, Johan, you say we can trigger a new wave of sustainable technological inventions to solve our ecological crisis. I just talked with another well-known Swede, Alf Hornborg. Alf says there is no technical solution to the problems of technology. We need social and ideological change instead. What are your thoughts?
Yes, and I know Alf Hornborg very well, and he raises a very important issue, and I'm so glad you bring this forward, because it's absolutely true. There's no convincing analysis to show that technological breakthroughs alone can take us towards a sustainable and equitable future with 10 billion co-citizens when we're a big world on a small planet. In fact, the pace by which we need to decarbonize our climate system, share the remaining rare earth metals, produce more than 50% food to feed humanity on existing land because we cannot expand into virgin ecosystems anymore. We cannot empty the oceans from more wild fish because we're running out of fish. These insights force us to recognize that technology can take us a certain part of the way, but we also need behavioral change, and that requires value change and particularly equity change. I mean, it's equally dramatic that we are a rich minority, some 1.5 billion of 7.2 billion people, who has caused the bulk of the global environmental risks on planet Earth. And it's equally, you know, acute to recognize that that minority is equivalent to the inequity challenge we're facing with, you know, a small percentage of the world's population owning more capital than 50% of the poorest in the world. So it's absolutely true that we have to combine a fourth industrial revolution not only with a deep sustainability mind shift, but also with a deep equity and values mind shift, and that all of this will require from us all a sense of behavioral change and lifestyle change, which has to be founded on the recognition that we have to share the remaining ecological space on Earth. But I really want to emphasize that that ethical dimension and this lifestyle change, there's no evidence to suggest that that's a sacrifice, that this is, you know, moving backwards. It's rather moving forward into the future. And I really want to remind ourselves that the real sacrifice, the time we would really have to give up on our lifestyles, is by continuing business as usual. Because business as usual is what all science shows will take us across tipping points, which would undermine our ability to have good lives. And therefore, the most dire sacrifice to our lifestyles is by continuing as usual. A sustainable future is so to say, the only pathway that could plausibly give us the room to allow ourselves to have a good future. So, you know, you have to combine these issues, but recognizing that a modern, thriving future is today basically prerequisited by a sustainable framework.
Well, given our situation, what are the most urgent problems we need to tackle first?
Well, our conclusion in the Big World Small Planet is that we have two major, let's say, urgent transformations we need to accomplish. And the first one is, not surprisingly, to bend the curve of emission of greenhouse gases and move rapidly towards a decarbonization of our entire world economy, which means leaving fossil fuels behind us. The number one issue is to halt all use of coal and coal-fired plants, deregulate or stop using oil and natural gas and move into renewable energy technologies. That is de facto an urgent challenge we face. And the second one is to transition into sustainable food production in the world, because it may surprise you that agriculture is the single largest cause behind us threatening planetary boundaries. Food production is the single world largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Agriculture is the single world's largest consumer of fresh water, the single world largest polluter of our waterways due to too much nitrogen, phosphorus, and chemicals. and the single largest loss of biodiversity. So sustainable food means a healthy planet. And moreover, which is quite interesting, is that sustainable food can also unlock many of the strategies towards more healthy diets. So I would say that the two most urgent challenges is to move towards a renewable energy future and a sustainable food future. And that would take us a long way in terms of a future within planetary boundaries.
And there is a program that you're involved in called Future Earth. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yes. You see, the planetary boundary framework, which then lands scientifically at the conclusion that we now need to define the Earth system processes that regulates the stability and resilience of the Earth system, and that we have to quantify biophysical boundaries within which we can have a safe future on a stable planet. All that evidence arises from 30 years of extraordinary advancement in global change research, what we call Earth system science, which simply put is the science of understanding how the Earth operates and also how we humans interact with Earth. Now, that science started in the 1970s and has progressed in a number of large international programs, from the World Climate Research Program to something called the International Human Dimensions Program and the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, looking at land and climate and atmosphere and interactions with the world economy. Now, some 5 years ago, the recognition was that now we have so much evidence that we're facing this urgent need to transform the world towards a global sustainable future, that this enormous advancement in Earth system science needs to take a next step, needs to basically integrate social natural sciences and needs to focus more on science exploring pathways for a sustainable future. And after a long consultation among scientists across the world, with stakeholders from business and policy and civil society, the result is Future Earth. So Future Earth is a step up of the global sustainability science community, from climate change to biodiversity to economics, to start and really address the integrated challenges and opportunities facing humanity to transition into a global sustainable future. And Future Earth has just started. It has, interestingly, a distributed headquarters where the U.S. is one of the hubs for the global leadership, based in Colorado, with a number of top scientists across the U.S., one hub in Sweden, one in Canada, one in Japan, and one in France. And Future Earth has the objective of being, you know, a science platform for collaborative research, searching solutions for humanity's transition towards a stable and resilient future.
For your book, Big World, Small Planet, you didn't team up with another scientist, but with a fairly famous photographer. You started talking about the role of beauty. What has beauty got to do with science and policy?
Yes, this might be surprising that a scientific conclusion after 30 years of Earth system science, combining, you know, linking climate science to complex research on ocean acidification, lands at a conclusion that a key message to humanity is that if we can safeguard the remaining beauty on Earth, we stand a very good chance of a prosperous future. And that might be surprising, but, you know, there's something fundamental here, and it is about the collision between emotions and the rational, between brain and heart, represented in the Big World, Small Planet with the science that we summarize and with the photography that Matthias is displaying. But our conclusion is serious, which is that we live in a world of rising cultural and religious and political turbulence. And we focus so much of our efforts on everything that is so different between the Muslim world and the Christian world and the North and the South, etc., and all the divides we have. But our hypothesis is that we have a universal value. We have a universal value across every culture, every nation, every corner of this planet, which is that every individual has a relationship to his or her nature at home, and that this nature is what we define as beauty, and that if we can safeguard the beauty we know, and if we all can do that, we stand a good chance of that adding up towards safeguarding the beauty of the planet. So if you look out of your window, what you really care for in nature, be it your closest tree or a little meadow or, as I have, just a little rocky spot on the coast of the Baltic Sea outside of the island where I live. These are fundamental, valuable, not to say prerequisites, for us to have a good planet that can continue to deliver human well-being. So the point is that, you know, coming back to this fundamental core of sustaining the beauty can be a key part of our mind shift towards a sustainable, innovative transformation in the future.
I have to agree, it's beauty that powers me and keeps me going even in difficult times. From Stockholm, we've been speaking with Johan Rockström, one of the world's preeminent natural scientists, I think I can say. Johan is co-author of the book Big World, Small Planet. He's the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center and teaches at Stockholm University. You can find links to his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Johan, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to this very important program.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Why is there such a rush to get out new vaccines for emergency use in the pandemic? Because millions already died from COVID around the world. In the United States, with over 3,000 deaths a day, nobody could wait for more testing. As you heard in this program, the climate situation is the same, and perhaps even more urgent. The United Nations just said every country needs to declare a climate emergency, no matter what else is going on. Even if our society and economy are teetering on the edge of collapse, so are our chances for a decent future. We need weather that humans, our crops, and all the species can live in. Everything is at stake. This is live or die stuff. We must all find out what the danger is and what we need to do to stabilize our home planet. I'm Alex Smith. Follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We go out with Change Change by the Canadian group Thistle.
Newspapers flying by, TV reporters cry every day. The news just gets worse while the rage of the people burns. Change, change. The power players in
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jeffrey Sachs on How We Can Make Peace with Russia by Learning from John F. Kennedy. The Community Church of Boston celebrated the 60th anniversary of Kennedy's speech on world peace in June 2023. They invited Professor Jeffrey Sachs to speak to the congregation. Sachs wrote a book on the American University speech entitled To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. Jeffrey Sachs is an economist, academic, public policy analyst, and director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Working for Peace is the mission of the Boston Community Church. And they watched a documentary of Kennedy's speech on world peace and then gathered to talk with Professor Sachs.
It is one of the greatest speeches of modern history and one of the most pertinent speeches for us today, for our very survival, because we are right now, again, at the brink of nuclear war. And those who say that we are not don't understand the world that we live in, don't understand the dangers that we face, don't understand the path of escalation in Ukraine, which has been a path of bluff and then counter-bluff and then escalation and counter-escalation. Not for the year plus since Russia's invasion on February 24th, 2022 took place, but for more than 30 years. I've seen at least some of it with my own eyes because I was an advisor to the economic team of President Mikhail Gorbachev. I was an advisor to President Boris Yeltsin. I was an advisor to President Leonid Kuchma, the first president of independent Ukraine. And I remember those days, and I've watched how, I'm sad to say, United States policies have wrecked the hopes of those days and put us on a path that now is causing shocking and shockingly dangerous devastation in Ukraine. Now, let me describe just a bit about the historical context of this speech. President Kennedy, in my view, was one of the great statesmen of the modern age. But the presidency is a very hard job, and President Kennedy came in fully committed to maintaining the peace, and yet because of the nature of U.S. politics and U.S. governance, and because of the nature of the Cold War in those days, nearly stumbled into nuclear annihilation, because that threat is hovering over the world in the modern time, and we don't eliminate it by closing our eyes. So President Kennedy came into office, of course, on January 20th, 1961, and gave one of the marvelous inaugural addresses that we remember to this day. And one of the messages in the inaugural address was, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. So President Kennedy came in determined to find a way to peace at the height of the Cold War. But the tensions were enormous at that time. One was the general context of the Cold War itself, which is that there never was a peace agreement after World War II, after Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender in May 1945, there was never a peace agreement or peace framework agreed. And what that meant was that the status of Germany was never determined. Germany in 1945 was occupied by the four victorious powers, the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. Those four powers divided Germany and they divided Berlin. The United States decided soon after the end of the war that Germany should be remilitarized. This was shocking to the Soviet Union, which had lost more than 20 million citizens to Nazi war making. And the Soviet Union was aiming for demilitarization of Germany or neutrality of Germany, but the United States decided that Germany would be remilitarized and would be the bulwark of a new U.S.-led military alliance, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This was never accepted by the Soviet Union, which pressed for some kind of resolution that would directly address Soviet security concerns. In 1955, just as a point of background, the Soviet Union, which was occupying part of Austria, agreed to withdraw its troops from the occupying zones of Austria in return for Austria's declaration of neutrality. And the Soviet leadership wanted to show to the United States and to the so-called Western world or the NATO countries that if Germany would be neutral rather than a NATO militarized country, the Soviet Union would withdraw not only from East Germany, but presumably from Central and Eastern Europe as well, because its security concerns would have been addressed. The United States would have nothing of it, however. Austria proved over the succeeding decades that neutrality was a marvelous solution for Austria. At the end of the 1950s, the German leader, Chancellor Adenauer, started to seek nuclear weapons. And Eisenhower was not really against that. And so there was talk about expanded access to nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union leadership was horrified. I could go on at length and should, if we had the time, to explain why by the time President Kennedy came into office, we were at the height of the Cold War. Soviet fears over a nuclear Germany, unsolved German issues, and rising tensions. In 1959-60, Fidel Castro also succeeded in toppling the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Batista in Cuba and established a revolutionary government. The United States immediately began plans to overthrow Castro, and Castro appealed for security to the Soviet Union. When we say, our leaders say today, any country can choose any allies, this is not exactly how Eisenhower regarded Castro's approach to the Soviet Union. Eisenhower gave the order to the CIA to devise a plan to overthrow Castro, and that plan landed on President Kennedy's desk in early 1961. That, of course, was the so-called Bay of Pigs invasion. President Kennedy was extremely wary and skeptical of this plan. But as a new president, he was not in a position, he felt, to countermand a plan that was in the works, that had landed on his desk, and where the CIA was pressing extraordinarily hard for this. The Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba by the United States was a massive debacle. Nikita Khrushchev wrote in a back channel to Kennedy, President Kennedy, there is a illegal piratical act being carried out by your government. President Kennedy unwisely responded by saying, this has nothing to do with us. This is not our affair. Nikita Khrushchev wrote back and said, don't lie again. The United States lied twice to the Soviet Union on matters of fundamental significance within a very short period of time. This was followed by the Berlin Wall going up in the summer of 61. And of course, Khrushchev's decision, extraordinarily unwise, reckless, to put offensive nuclear weapons into Cuba. Khrushchev was aiming not at war. He was aiming at showing the U.S. a taste of its own medicine. The U.S. had nuclear weapons in Turkey, near to the Soviet Union. The U.S. had invaded Cuba. The U.S. had not listened to Soviet concerns over a nuclear Germany. Khrushchev aimed to make a point. What a terrible way to do it. Because, of course, when the shipments of these missiles and their placement in Cuba was discovered by U-2 flights over Cuba in October 1962, they nearly led to full-scale nuclear war. A point that I think is extremely important to appreciate is that almost every advisor of President Kennedy in the early days of the Cuban Missile Crisis said to attack. Kennedy decided on a diplomatic approach. And it was Kennedy's diplomatic approach and fundamentally a compromise where the U.S. withdrew its missiles from Turkey and the Soviet Union withdrew its missiles from Cuba, and the United States pledged never again to invade Cuba, that the Cuban Missile Crisis was brought to an end. Or I should say nearly so, because there's one more thing to know. After Kennedy and Khrushchev agreed on unwinding the crisis, after a disabled Soviet submarine thought that it was being attacked by U.S. Navy pilots dropping depth charges and live grenades, apparently, on the submarine, and the captain of the submarine ordered the firing of a nuclear-tipped torpedo. Under U.S. military doctrine of that day, October 27, 1962, had that nuclear-tipped torpedo been fired, it was the doctrine of the United States, championed by reckless generals such as Curtis LeMay, that the U.S. would unleash a full, unconstrained nuclear attack against the Soviet Union and all countries deemed by the United States to be in the Soviet camp, meaning Central and Eastern Europe and China. The estimates of the Pentagon were that such a full-scale attack would have killed 700 million people. That was the U.S. plan. Found out later from Carl Sagan and other scientists that it would have killed all of humanity by creating a nuclear winter. When the captain ordered the nuclear torpedo to be fired, the order was countermanded by the commodore of the squadron, by the person who saved the world that you never heard of, Vasily Arkhipov, who said, no, we will surface, we will not fire. This event for me illustrates, epitomizes our fate. We are subject to self-made annihilation by accident, by mistake, by insanity, by cruelty, by miscalculation, by calculation. And we don't understand it to this day, how dangerous and reckless our own actions are. So, in the aftermath of all of this, Kennedy, who came into office to be a peacemaker, embarked on one of the greatest acts of statesmanship in modern history. And the final year of Kennedy's life was a year of miracles. He led the peaceful end of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He and Khrushchev wrote to each other, and Khrushchev was also a man of peace. They wrote to each other saying, we must pull back from the brink. We cannot go on this way. And Kennedy embarked on a year of peacemaking that was a mix of vision, political genius, and statesmanship of the highest order. Because making peace at the height of the Cold War, in the immediate aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, required a deftness and skill and bravery that is almost unimaginable. This speech that we just listened to on June 10, 1963 was part of that peace campaign. He humanizes the other side, exactly the opposite of what we get every day from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, our so-called mainstream media, with their warmongers, their reckless reporters, their desire to humiliate the other side. Kennedy aimed to humanize the other side When Nikita Khrushchev read the speech the next day, June 11, 1963, he called the U.S. envoy, President Kennedy's envoy to Russia, Avril Harriman, and told Avril Harriman, "I want to make peace with your president." And within 5 weeks, the two parties signed the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. 5 weeks later, President Kennedy then took the peace campaign to the American people, because the generals, the military-industrial complex, was either passively, aggressively opposed to this kind of peacemaking. President Kennedy went out to the West and gave speeches. The American people rallied to the cause of peace. And when the vote in the U.S. Senate came, it was 80-19 in favor of ratification. President Kennedy's last great speech to the world was to celebrate this achievement, this treaty, when President Kennedy spoke to world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly in September 1963, just weeks before his assassination. And then President Kennedy looked out to the world leaders and said, "Fellow citizens of the world, let us take our stand at this time and in this place to see if we can help move the world toward peace." And of course he did, and then was killed a few weeks later. Many people, including myself, believe that it was because of his peace initiative, probably rogue elements of the U.S. government, perhaps the CIA and others. Of course, we don't know for sure. But in any event, President Kennedy had achieved the ultimate in global statesmanship and in peacemaking. And as the Beatitude says, blessed are the peacemakers. Well, what President Kennedy taught us about making peace in that speech is absolutely directly relevant for us today. First, he said, "Do not dehumanize or denigrate the other side. They are human beings. They want peace the same way we do." He said, "Communicate." And I keep hoping. President Biden, pick up the phone, send a Zoom link, talk to your counterpart, talk to Vladimir Putin. Stop the sound bites. Stop the finger pointing, because those of us who know the whole history of this conflict, which goes back more than 30 years, knows how many times the United States has provoked this war. Pick up the phone and negotiate. And President Kennedy said words that are so relevant that I want to remind us. He said, above all, in other words, the most important message, above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. It is so obvious to any experienced person in this, and I've watched this personally for more than 30 years close up, that there is no military route to Ukraine's security, because if we were to put Russia in the choice of a humiliating defeat or nuclear war, for example, the conquest by force over Crimea, rather than negotiating, we will do exactly what President Kennedy tells us would be a death wish for humanity. President Obama understood this in 2014. Even though President Obama unwisely, very unwisely, and Hillary Clinton very unwisely, and Victoria Nuland directly when she was Assistant Secretary of State, participated in the violent overthrow of the Ukraine president. President Obama knew, do not put this onto a path of war, because he said at the time, Russia has escalatory dominance, meaning that if we escalate, they will escalate. If we escalate, they will escalate. And because the issues facing Russia are perceived by Russia to be fundamental to Russia's national security, and that is the opposition to having a U.S.-led military alliance expand to the 2,000-kilometer border with Russia, that Russia would escalate to nuclear arms if necessary. So Obama was smart not to start on that path. But ladies and gentlemen, we are on that path now, because President Biden, Victoria Nuland, who was promoted from her role in the overthrow of Yanukovych to being Undersecretary of State, Jake Sullivan, who was part of that story, who is now not the National Security Advisor to the Vice President, but the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, have been on the path of pushing NATO enlargement, irrespective of reckless risk, irrespective of Russian red lines. Even last week, the Washington Post ran a story, which was shocking, but in our benumbed media environment, passed without notice. The story said Biden more and more ignores Russia's red lines. And then reckless voices of the military-industrial complex were quoted as saying, yes, that's bluff, they keep going, rather than we get closer and closer to nuclear war. So this is where President Kennedy's speech is of fundamental and inestimable value to us today. For more than 30 years, the United States has pressed relentlessly an idea of expanding NATO in order to surround Russia in the Black Sea region. The whole idea was to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO so that there would be a ring surrounding Russia, including Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Georgia. This was spelled out already in the late 1990s, and apparently it was on the planning books, from what I'm told by historians, already in 1992. And now we are at war, and we are a deep threat, and we have not seen peacemaking. We haven't even seen communication. All we know about diplomacy is that at the end of 2021, when President Putin put on the table a draft U.S.-Russia security agreement based on NATO non-enlargement, the United States said that is non-negotiable. It's none of your business where NATO goes. Then in March 2022, a few weeks after the Russian invasion, but mind you, 8 years after the real start of the war with the violent overthrow of Yanukovych, but a few weeks after the February 24th invasion, Russia and Ukraine were at the negotiating table, with Turkey being mediator, and they were close to an agreement based on Ukraine's neutrality, and the United States blocked it. So until today, the United States has done the opposite of never fear to negotiate. Thank you very much for bringing us together to heed the wisdom of President Kennedy His wisdom can keep the world alive and safe, and we need to act on it. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Jeffrey Sachs. He spoke to the congregation of the Boston Community Church on June 10, 2023. They celebrated the 60th anniversary of Kennedy's speech on world peace. Sachs is an economist, academic, and public policy analyst. He's president of the United Nations Sustainable Solutions Network and an SDG advocate for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Thanks to the Community Church of Boston for the excerpts of their meeting with Jeffrey Sachs. You can find the full two-hour Zoom recording on YouTube under the title Professor Jeffrey Sachs on How We Can Make Peace with Russia. That includes a lively Q&A session, and it all ends with a performance of a beautiful piece of choral music composed to the words from JFK's speech on peace. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the martyr dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. When all ahead seemed dark as night, it witnessed many its beaten vow. We mustn't change its color now. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past, it gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll never die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. His mind's affixed on stealth and place, to cringe beneath the rich man's frown and haul that sacred emblem down. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.